There's a poem by Dogen which says, "Although I wish to help all beings cross over the bridge, all it ends up being is that I myself am helped to cross over the bridge." And there's a story of a somebody completing an exam in high school or university. And I don't know whether they do it in this country, but they had to sign a thing at the end which said that they hadn't cheated. You know, they hadn't received or given any help. And so one of the people wrote at the bottom of the exam, "I ain't received any help on this exam, and Lord knows I couldn't give any." And I feel somewhat like that now. As most of you know, certainly any of the local people would know, we've just been through the conclave, which sometimes when people hear about such meetings, they want to be there, and believe me, you really miss nothing, except I've got more gray hairs than I did at the beginning of the enterprise. And so I find myself in the situation of wanting to, I will talk about myself as I did the other day, and my own response to events, and partly the reason I wasn't at the ceremony actually is that I was overtaken by training in the garden, if I can put it that way, and being Canadian, I didn't think the sight of me crying and whirling about would have done the ceremony much good, so I decided to wait until I was, you know how we always want to make our karma and lives more tidier and presentable before we take them out and show them to other people, or before we look at them ourselves. And I'm again going to do something uncharacteristic and recommend a book that I highly recommend. Although sometimes when, you know, people highly recommend books, other people look at them and think, you know, what the heck were they thinking? It's by a woman called Joy Kogawa, K-O-G-A-W-A, Kogawa, called The Rain Ascends, that I came across a number of years ago, and that I highly recommend as being very, very apropos to the present situation and of the departure of the abbot. You know, otherwise people are not going to know what I'm referring to, presumably. Very, very apropos, and in a rather startling way, very much about the theme of the particular festival, because it's the encounter with what the woman calls the Goddess of Mercy in the middle of the most startling circumstances. And just to let people know, it isn't that the circumstances in the book are the same as the present ones. It's more the encounter with sorrow and tragedy that, and in people that you can't make easy sense of, that you can't put very nicely into little categories. I sometimes think what we want to do is we want the impact of karma and suffering to be like a series of vitamin pills. You know, we can put them in dosage and take, you know, each day or each hour a manageable dose. And fortunately, it doesn't really happen that way. Because I think sometimes if it were in manageable doses, we wouldn't actually learn from it. in November of last year, I was meditating up in, you know, my temple in British Columbia, and I was trained here at Shasta, as many of you know. I was from Master Jiyu's disciple and chaplain for a number of years and knew her really well, and have always felt part of this, the monastic family of this temple, very, very much so. And I've always been connected into it in a very, very strong way, as everybody knows. And sitting in meditation, I was actually more contemplating that I had reached the age of 55 and I was reasonably happy with my life. You know, foolish me, right? You know, reasonably happy with my life, reasonably content. And why didn't I take a little sabbatical, if I can put it that way, and go and spend several months in Throssel, you know, where I had really enjoyed being there. I have a disciple that I've trained and named as a master myself, and so he could look after things. And as I say, this was last November. So I'm sitting there, you know how it is in terms of sitting. You know, one's mind is distracted by pleasant things, and you think, oh, that would be nice, I could go to Throssel, be nice, all those nice hills and moors. Well, you know how it is. I've really learned with meditation, or at least this is where I am with it, that it's our relationship to it that changes, rather than we expect to change ourselves. Okay, here's the funny thing about it. It's actually our relationship to our koan that changes, rather than the koan itself. In any case, I'm getting to the climax. And I'm sitting there, and this very, very rarely happens for me, maybe about three times in my monastic or training life. Once before River Master Jiyu died, several months before, and once when, some years ago, I applied for a visa to stay here after my monastic life was turned down by the delightful U.S. government and had to leave in a matter of 2 weeks back to Canada, nowhere to go. That's another story. And, okay, I'm sitting there in meditation, not thinking of anything in particular, you know, like they say, in the instructions, when very, very clear and very, very distinctly, with nothing before it, the abbot of Shasta will abandon his seat. And although it's the nature of certainty arising in meditation, I think, my opinion is, okay, I have this happen, but I don't think that, I didn't take it to be a prophecy of anything in particular. I just didn't know, but it was strong enough to email River Master Hario and say, this is what has happened to me. I am not saying this is about to happen. I am just saying this is what has happened to me. And I wrote it down and dated it. It was 6 months to the day that he actually left. I did not know what to make of it because I didn't have any particular reason for thinking that this would happen. Okay. Because we always suppose in training that the continuance. I mean, that's the thing with all of us, isn't it? I mean, I've been thinking about that, and if somebody were to say, in terms of all the people I know in training, you know, do you think any of them are a little bit strange? And I would have to say, well, actually, now that I think of it, you know, we're all a bit strange. I don't know if you've heard that Quaker saying that my mother used to quote, everybody here is a little bit strange, except me and thee. And sometimes I have my doubts about thee. So in any case, you know, I put it to one side and left it at that. And it comes down in a way that is connected with the with what Great Compassion is about, with about encompassing that which we cannot, in fact, encompass. We try as human beings, is the nature of shock, to enclose everything that occurs within the confines of the brain or the skull, if you know what I mean. And, as I say, try to put things in neat piles. And particularly, I'm not being rude, when we live in California, or at least by other people's standards who are rather envious, every time people heard when I was in Newfoundland, which is where I come from, that I was going to California, they would always say, it must be nice, all those palm trees. And they wouldn't understand that there weren't any, but they said, yeah, it must be nice, all that warmth and palm trees. That when our lives get to a certain level of manageability, you know, many people here probably led rather wild and misspent youths, or maybe nobody. But, you know, and after a while in training, it becomes the koan of middle age training. Or at least so it seems to me, but it may not apply to everybody here, that one's life gets in some sort of semblance of order. One kind of likes oneself, or at least is willing to live with oneself. And life seems at least somewhat manageable. I know some people will say, well, no, my life is so busy, it isn't manageable. But in actual fact, if you think back to the wild and misspent youth, it's reasonably manageable compared with that. And you kind of like yourself, and it's in the middle, to some degree, for many people, before one's friends and relatives start popping off, if you know what I mean. And when it gets to that particular point, one can begin to have the sort of the creeping sense, sometimes it creeps upon one without one really recognizing it. And I realize I'm not speaking to everybody's situation here, but I've certainly noticed it. What the question arises in various ways, and sometimes not very clearly, but why train? Why am I doing this? You know, why am I putting on this thing around my neck, you know, like in the morning? Why am I wearing the lay minister's robes? What does this mean exactly? And, or any aspect of one's life. You know, they talk about the 7-year itch in men, and people in their marriages, and people in their circumstances, and people in their monastic lives too. You know, where people look at and think, gosh, I never noticed it before. I was too busy. What does this make sense? Okay, so there's that aspect of it as well. In the book by Joy Kogawa, when I first saw the book in a bookstore, it said The Rain Ascends. And I thought, that's a rather odd title. It must be a Buddhist title. I don't know why I thought that, but so I picked it up and was reading it, and suddenly ran smack into, as one does, I don't want to give away anything of the book, but of my encounter with it, with Kuan Yin, you know, Avalokiteshvara, who turns up in the middle of this most unlikely novel of a situation, a koan, that it is impossible. Okay. One cannot put it in neat packages. One cannot, like I said to people the other day, there's a Canadian characteristic of when there's a large amount of poo on the floor, we kind of want to arrange it more nicely. You know what I mean? Surely if we can, you know, maybe mush it together so it looks kind of like a square block, you know, maybe somebody will mistake it for chocolate or something like that. You know, or it's a characteristic. It's not a very American cultural cast characteristic. I don't think, anyway. The tendency is to step into it. As a desire, I don't mean by accident. I mean I deliberate on purpose because of reality. We must encounter reality, must we not? I mean, I think, please let's not before it encounters us. So in this book, and in many circumstances in life, particularly going on past that point of where we wonder what's the point. Because believe me, if we wait just a little while, we will encounter with the reason why we are training. Okay, it's just we have these little hiatuses. And in the book, as I say, there is a phrase. The lady's writing is extremely beautiful. Extremely beautiful writing. So again, I highly recommend it. She says, in the middle of it all, this is the grace that is given, the presence of mercy and her ascending rain. And with my new acquaintance with the internet, I of course went and Googled ascending rain, which didn't do me much good. It's the name of a Christian rock band. But I couldn't find out why they had called it that, even though I checked through, you know, their websites trying to find out why the heck are they using this term. And it's mentioned as a paradox in works on English literature. They again say, a paradox, like the ascending rain, but they don't tell you where they got it either. So I have no idea where the phrase originally comes from, except that scientifically what it said was, and please, any scientist present, please forgive me. My knowledge of, you know, of that is somewhat limited, but it said that a definition of rain is that the sun causes the various particles of water to ascend until they reach the point where they encounter cold air and condense and fall as rain. Who would have thought, huh? Reverend Master Jiyu, in, I think, How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, describes the process of sitting in meditation, where she talks about turning the wheel, as some of you are familiar with. And in one of the places, she talks about it as a principle of condensation. Are you familiar with that? Where she talks about steam, no? Rising up the back and coming to the top and condensing into terms of in rain and falling. I have a nyoi, you know what a nyoi is, those lotus scepters that I found in a flea market, you know, that they carry the curved staff that goes like that, carry during ceremonies. It has a series of dragons on it going up it. And then when it reaches the top, there's a single carved drop of water. And down on the bottom, there's like a pool. And after reading the book, and a number of other things, including the Nyoi and other little bits and pieces, a number of things came together for me at a Lytton near where we live. Is a very, very small, it's a village of about 200 people, less than 200 people, surrounded by native Indian reserves. of over 1,000 people. A place of that has endured enormous amount of suffering. They told me that actually last year was the first year where no young person died during the graduation period, either by killing themselves or by a car accident with alcohol or by being lying on the railroad tracks or somewhat similar. It's a place of old suffering. It's also a place where two rivers come together, one cloudy and one clear. And the mixing of all the different elements come there. I'm very glad we settled there, actually. We've been made very welcome. And one of the things is that there's a small, what in the city would be called an interfaith. But given that they're only Baha'is, Buddhists, and various other people, I don't know how much you can call it interfaith. And started off with one of the local librarian inviting various people to get together on a Sunday afternoon, and everybody contribute a prayer of some sort or a spiritual reading or something along those lines. And we all know one another. And so she invited us, I suppose, in terms of, you know, gosh, there's another religion in Lytton. So we started to go. And as I say, various people contribute either various prayers. We usually, Aurelian and I, they always want us to sing the dedication of merit. Although some of the people there thought that it couldn't be sung without the inkin being struck. They said we were going to sing it, but we knew you couldn't do it unless the little inkin is struck. We said, go ahead. And they also particularly liked the, you weep in all the sorrows of the world. And again, they would ask us at the end of the thing to sing it. And so one time when we were there, and everybody was contributing, and I think also, everybody tries to be still, and I think also, well, from time to time, people will mention various people in the local community, because what happens with us in Lytton is whenever there's somebody's killed or a helicopter crashed recently with two of the pilots fighting fires there, somebody in the village will phone us, Aurelian and I and Winifred, and ask that we say prayers, is the way people put it, or dedicate merit. So we're always informed when anything like that happens, so that we can do that and are very much part of the local community. And as we were sitting around, as I say, I had a sense, very strong one, of just what the ascending rain means. And it is the sense that, like the lady said, the grace that is given is the continuous presence of mercy. And that is that as we sit, when we sit in meditation, when we sit here, you know, like that picture where Master Jiu drew over visions of the Sea of Lotuses, the water is always present. We sit in it now. We just don't pay very much attention to it. It's almost like we sit and dabble our feet in it. It is always present. And like that commentary on the precepts about the wheel of the Dharma rolls constantly, lacks nothing and needs something, it requires our effort to cause it to rise. And then when it reaches the point, it condenses. And then it rains down and benefits not only ourselves, but everybody. And I realized that as we were sitting doing that in Lytton, that is what it's about. Teresa of Avila, who, as you know, many of you know if you've been around for a long time, Reverend Master Jiu, in the very early days, Reverend Master Jiu would try anything that that poor lady could think of to convey some aspect of things. Anything. You know, like she was constantly searching for any possible thing that could get across to our thick skulls, you know, some aspect of what we were supposed to be doing. And given that, in a very real sense, when she began, she was actually the only person present who knew what we were aiming for. You know, if you think of it that way, there's this poor old lady and she's trying to get from point A to point B, and she's the only one who has any idea where point B is. And what she has is people with enormous amounts of energy, because everybody was young. And in, you remember young. Kind of, it makes one exhausted to think of it. With all due respect to those who are young, believe me. And she would try anything. And as I said, she had very enthusiastic people, but and a lot of energy. So one of the things she did was to try to find relevant things from the West, because there was also not, I mean, nowadays there's so much books on Buddhism. When she started, I remember when I first started, you know, there would be a single line of books, you know, very, very narrow in the local bookstore. Now there are walls and walls and walls of them. And I don't know whether the situation has in fact improved. Because I'm a Zen, I've been a Zen monk for 30-something years, and this is, well, I don't understand most of the books on Zen. I must confess, I have no idea what they're talking about. I read them and I think, gosh, I guess I don't understand it. In any case, Teresa d'Avila talks about the 4 degrees of what she calls the four waters, or the 4 degrees of prayer. And she said, it's using the Spanish metaphor, she said, it's as if you're starting out to grow a garden. She said, initially, you're dragging water up from the well by means of a bucket, a very deep well. She said, it requires a lot of effort to do, a lot of attention. She talks about, actually, she's very interesting because it's an exact description of what her Master Chief was talking about. She said, you have to put a lot of attention in what you're doing. The distractions are much, much, you know, very, very heavy, and they come in all the time. It's very difficult to concentrate the mind because, of course, she's talking about meditation. And she said, at a certain point, there's a water wheel that brings the water up from the well. And it turns, and you have to turn it, and it's a lot easier, okay, at least than pulling it up by the bucket, going like that. And you put effort into the water wheel. And then she talks about further how when a stream emerges out of the desert and flows down, and then that waters the garden. It's at that point that we, what Reverend Master Jiu used to talk about, well, I won't go into the Sumeru altar, but what Reverend Master Jiu used to talk about, the point at which one has to let go of what one thinks the path is. Because oftentimes in training, or at least this is my experience, one, just as one settles down, like I was doing up on the mountain, to think, well, yeah, you know, I think I have some idea what this training business is, and I'm reasonably comfortable with myself, and, you know, I think I'll go and have a nice time at Throssell. It'll be so pleasant, all those lovely moors. And English sensibilities, which since I was raised in Newfoundland, I'm very comfortable with English sensibilities. I think I've lost my thread. Yes, I know it's water from beginning to end. Thank you for being so helpful. I beg your pardon?
You said you were confident that you knew the
medicine. Oh, yeah. Okay. But what I mean is, well, I wasn't, but but just at that point, everything changes. So just at the point where one thinks, I know what this matter of training is, it's a matter of this continuous effort, you know, of shaping the poo until it's a nicer shape, you know, of trying to excise those aspects of oneself that one does not like, you know, or spending a good deal of time wishing. You know how that is. At least this is the way it goes for me. You know, I wish I wasn't so cranky. You know? And I don't like myself when I feel cranky. And it doesn't do much good that other people tell you you're not really cranky. That doesn't help, does it? You know? Or when other people are very understanding of one's situation, such as telling one how good, what good benefit it is to wear these sort of hookups, you know, to benefit other beings. And you sort of think, okay, you know, like being hooked up to a defibrillator. And in any case, like that, she talks about of coming to the point where the water wheel, one has put all the effort into the water wheel, and then suddenly one discovers that there is a stream of water flowing. That, as far as one knows, doesn't belong to one. And as far as one knows, one didn't do anything to deserve, except all that work with the well and the water wheel. And then she talks about a step further, what she calls great rain, or the great rain that falls. And this is very much, for me, connected with that rain, the ascending rain of mercy. Particularly if we have some idea, however small, of what it is to sit still. Frequently, and again, I may be only speaking of my own, from my own koan, but frequently my experience with people is, and I think it's one of a big impediment for people coming from a Western background, not with everybody, but with many people, is that we lack or have difficulty in confidence in the Dharma, in the teaching. I was at a thing, or I may have heard it, I'm not sure which, where the Dalai Lama, yeah, I was present actually, the Dalai Lama was asked about the koan of self-hatred. You know, this was a crowd of Western thing. What was interesting to me is he didn't understand what the people were talking about. He said, how can you hate yourself? And I thought, well, actually, most people in this room could give you dissertations on the subject. He said, how can you hate yourself? The Dharma is about confidence. And so I think when I say that people need to rely upon the fact that they know a bit about sitting still, you can almost hear people say, oh, I don't know anything about sitting still. Well, you're managing it to some degree at the moment. One has to trust in a funny, funny way, because I think a lot of the aspects of training are in fact very funny. I think that's why the Buddha had such a very dry sense of humor. The water is there. It is that we sit at this very moment in a great pool of it, an extensive pool of it. You know, it actually, we are, it's, I don't know if you've ever heard that sort of visionary experience of watching that everybody sits in it. The waters of mercy, the waters of compassion. Lap at our toes, you know, and pick up our feet, and we are actually paddling in it, but we're actually paying no attention to it whatsoever. Training, meditation, and sitting still, even to turn the heart in the good direction. Because all a religious tradition is a container for it, a means of pointing. It is not the thing itself. Just as to see somebody in the Buddhist tradition as a teacher, one makes a grave mistake and error if one then thinks that the Dharma resides in the teacher. Because it does not. And again, that is a very, very, very common to the Western koan. Okay? Whether it comes out of original sin or the desire to seek for a savior or a cranky Middle Eastern deity, I don't know exactly. But it does seem to be a very, very common thing. And relates back to what I had heard the Dalai Lama say. So, we are sitting in the water all the time. It's like that koan of the master fanning themselves, you know, that some of you would have read. Well, it's like the water. Since the water is always present, and this guy up here is saying that it is, since it is always present, well then, why do we need to do anything about it? You know? Why can't we just sit and imagine that we're experiencing it? And that is where the actual meaning of the Bodhisattva vow comes in. When we sit, when we offer merit, when we turn the heart towards the good, then we cause the water to rise and the rain to ascend. And it isn't a case that we have to sit there, because this is a very common, my experience in a Western koan, is people wait for the teacher to cause the rain to ascend. Okay? They do it all the time. I'm going to have a brief cranky moment right now about that very subject. We did two sagakis up on the mountain recently, one for a set of Chinese donors and one for the congregation, which we do regularly. And when you're the celebrant for something like that, you know, and you're used to for years being the one who tries to keep the blessed thing going, while people are standing to the side thinking, I'm not sure I believe this. I'm not sure I want to be here. I think I'm going to leave and have a nice pastrami on rye sandwich right after this. I'm not sure I know these words, you know. It was nice having the, mind you, the Chinese have their own cultural koan, which one doesn't wish to exchange for ours, believe me. But we had about 7 or 8 Chinese lay people there who had taken precepts. Now, they have the opposite problem. They've never asked questions. They're not, you know, when they're raised in it, they've got their grandmothers say, don't ask questions, just do it, whack. Which is not particularly helpful either. But they don't stand there thinking of something else. You know, and when they recite the Kanzan, the Kanzan scripture when we do it during Sagaki, they're not in a quandary of, well, you know, I'm not trying to believe this, beyond, does she really exist, or what is she, or all these sorts of things. They think, you know, homage to the blessed, merciful, the greatly compassionate, regard of the cries of the world. You know, and don't worry. And that has its advantages. It certainly helps make the rain ascend. And so I think part of this is to allow oneself a teeny tiny aspect of confidence in one's own training. I don't think most people here are going to go hog wild and think, I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know what I mean? So I think mostly probably addressing inadequacy koans seems to be common enough. The other ones we can deal with. I've encountered adequacy koans not very many times in my life. Once somebody coming for spiritual training, a monk actually, years and years ago, who was gone to another life, and who said to me, how do I prevent the lay people from being overwhelmed by my spiritual certainty? And I sat there with my mouth open, actually, wondering, how the heck do I begin to address this? One, I'm so used to saying, there, there, dear, it'll be all right. You know, don't worry, you can do it. And, you know, one almost feels like maybe the only solution is the old one of whacking the person, you know, which Buddhist monks are technically not supposed to strike other people. But I sometimes understand that end of that koan story where it says in the Chinese, then the master struck his beloved disciple. I sort of think, well, yeah, okay, I can sort of see they probably shouldn't have done that, but I can understand the motivation. So there has to be confidence in the ability of the Dharma, and not the Dharma as some sort of abstract thing, okay? Because I'm sure some people have the koan I do, or did, that the more books you accumulate on the Dharma, that somehow the more it's going to sink in, which if you think of it, because part of the Dharma in training is examining very clearly our foolish, self-perpetuating notions. And if we get to them on the level where they're foolish and the tiny little self-perpetuating, we'll do a little bit better later on. Somebody once said to Reverend Master Jiyu when she was going to be very direct with somebody, what about if you puncture their balloon? And she said, yes, but what about if you don't? And then it becomes a leathery old balloon. Very difficult to puncture. So it's much better to start off. I've also known people to look around and look for the big problems, you know, rather than the tiny little ones. Like, what are we doing now? What are we doing at this very minute? What's going through the mind at this very second? You know, that's the interesting, never boring part. And to make the rain ascend is, and rain down, is that combination of our own will, if I can put it that way. It's kind of like the process of will transforming into willingness, like Teresa of Avila is describing. The will and the effort is put in until it reaches the top, if I can put it that way, where it condenses and then it falls as rain. And it's like the circulating of the breath, you know, at least the way I was taught. You know, it can take a great deal of effort to bring it up here, and then you let go of it, and it is rain. And some years ago, there was a conversation at one of the Sagaki festivals here I think it occurred during a class, but it doesn't matter. When somebody said, and forgive me if the people are present, because I'm not trying to make fun, but presumably they've learned, said, well, you know, this idea of generating merit for all the hungry ghosts, well, what about if they aren't deserving hungry ghosts? You know, what about if they're not making sufficient effort? You know, here I am giving their method, you know, like, was it welfare bum hungry ghosts? You know what I mean? And, of course, it doesn't work like that any more than one thinks that I will cause the rain to ascend for the sake of myself alone. It's like a Chalanatha and Kansan on either side of the altar. Kansan is going up the back. No, sorry. I do get my iconography mixed up. A Chalanatha is the effort put in to go up the back. Avalokiteshvara pours out the water and it comes down. As you probably have heard, Soto Zen altars in particular, all Buddhist altars, but Soto Zen altars in particular, are set up to represent the internal process of training, all aspects of them. And so, to come back to this book, what the lady says is, and this is a novel, in the midst of the fire of loathing, this is the grace that is given, the presence of mercy and her ascending rain. And while we were at the conclave, and I was trying to practice, it's an excellent opportunity to practice the paramita of patience, because it's so easy to think that one sees clearly, you know, oh yes, I know what we can do with this rule, you know, this is the way we proceed, and here's this annoying person over there who has just brought up this issue which is entirely irrelevant, you know, and I wish it would stop. And so then you of course don't say that, or I don't say that. And an excellent opportunity to practice patience. And in the middle of it, I was trying to restrain my patience by writing a little homage to the Buddha many, many, many times in my book. In the middle of anything that works is very much what you used to say. And so I condensed the whole of that passage into three or four little lines. Grace given, mercy's presence, ascending rain. Grace given, mercy's presence, ascending rain. The grace that is given is always the presence of mercy. Not looking for it to be poured down from the sky, but that which we ourselves have to do. The old poem about Kuan Yin. The body of Kuan Yin is neither male nor female. Even the body is not a body. Think and know very carefully. The bodhisattva is you, not the image or the picture.